I have 1:15 on my clock here, but I think we'll wait a few more minutes to give people who are coming to Eureka for the first time a few more minutes to get here. While we're waiting, would somebody check and see if the stream is going out? The stream should have started at 1:15. Testing 1, 2, 3. Forensics 1, 2, 3. Forensics 4, 1, 1, 4. Sounds like I'll be competing with whatever's happening next door. Looks like we don't have many stragglers, so I think I'll just get started. Welcome everybody to Introduction to Digital Forensics, IMT 4114. I am your host, Carl Stewart Leichter. Joining us this morning will be Dr. Edgar Lopez and Jan William Jensen. Dr. Lopez and Mr. Jensen will introduce themselves forthwith, but first let's start out by making sure that everybody's here for the same reason. We're going to have an introduction to the introduction today, starting off by who we are, and then we'll give you some information about the course, contents, papers, projects, etc. This is an introductory level course. It's being offered through both master's and bachelor's students. Most of the material is the same. If you're a master's student, you will earn 7.5 ECTS. If you are a bachelor's student, you will earn 5.5 ECTS. The difference is the amount of work that you will do and the complexity of the work. We will have multiple lectures, about 6 lectures in total, and then the 7th lecture will be you giving your project presentations. The final 6th lecture is optional for the bachelor's, but you can come to the lecture if you wish. If you take this for bachelor's credit and then you move on to take the MIS master's stream, you cannot take this course again as a master's student and get the full 7.5 ECTS. You will get reduced credit. Let's see. Now, if you have taken a course here before, you are probably familiar with something called a reference group. This is something that you will form democratically amongst yourselves. I recommend that you form it democratically amongst yourselves. If you don't do that, then it will be up to us, the course shepherds, to form it for you. The reference group will be essentially a liaison between the students and the instructors, and you will also evaluate us, the instructors. Please always check the time plan to find out the most up-to-date information about the course schedule. The times can sometimes change. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce the project coordinator, Dr. Edgar Lopez. Edgar, if you would.
So I guess I need to talk close
to
the microphone.
Talk into the microphone.
Okay, I'm Edgar Lopez. As Carr introduced me, I'm going to be the project coordinator. How many of you have already a group, reference group? Okay, how many don't have a group? Raise your hand. Hi. Because look at each other. Maybe you can talk a little bit during the break and form a group. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the Digital Forensics Lab. I started in March, so I'm very recent here. When Carl mentioned Dr. Edgar, I just got a doctor's degree last year, so I'm still new and try to update it for that. Well, my research, my area is fraud detection for financial transactions. I'm using simulation mods for this, but we're not here to talk about my research. We're here to talk about the forensics project. So how many of you the hack group has selected a topic? Okay, which one is your topic? Sorry. What? Okay, smartphones. And so another, this way? Yeah, some other topics? Okay, anti-forensics. So many of you know that this project is going to be run during the whole semester, and it comes towards the 50% of the course grade. So half of your course here is going to be the project. The other half is going to be the written examination. That will be more information about that, I guess, today. Yeah. So we will have a lot of deliverables over the course. But there is one final deliverable that matters, and it's the final report. So the final report is the one that is going to have the final grade, and it's going to be from A to F. There will be oral presentation of the project, and it's going to be pass or fail. So just to give you a summary of all the deliverables, the first one you see here is the title and abstract. How many of you have seen the assignment in the Blackboard? Only a few of you? Okay. So you know this is the first assignment you have, and the deadline is next week. It's important to select the title and abstract because there are some overlapping of topics because there are many groups and fewer topics. So if two groups choose the same topic, we want to make sure that you don't have exactly the same approach in the topic. So it's interesting to know what is your approach. So in case there is some collision, we will try to give you some feedback and see how can you take a different approach. If you have any questions, let me know. Any questions over there? Or okay. Well, it might be a mistake here and you just point it out, but anyway. So the second deliverable is the project proposal. You can see it over here. Project proposal has a type of character of mandatory. The title and abstract is not. And this is because we want the title and abstract to be like a step ahead on the project to try to choose this fast. But we also understand that some people don't have that much experience in digital forensics. How many of you have experience in digital forensics? 1, 2, 3, 4. So yeah, so it's probably in the beginning it will take a bit longer for you. So that's why the project proposal is mandatory, and you will have 2 weeks for that. We want to keep some follow-up on the project. So we want to have or to give you the most out of, we want to give you feedback out of your work. So that's why we stated one deliverable that is called midterm report here. So the midterm report will be in the middle of October, and it will be a character of optional. And the content of this report, we will show it later, but it's basically the same final report. It's just like you can obtain some feedback of what you have been doing, and we can reorientate your project in case we see some problems, or we can just tell you, yeah, you're doing a good job, keep going on.
One interjection. While the deadline for the midterm report is optional, if you want feedback, then you must submit the midterm report by that deadline. If you submit after the deadline, you will not receive feedback.
Yeah, that's also very important. We will try to give you feedback over all the submissions that you have, but we're not going to be able to provide you proper feedback on the midterm report if you submit 2 days before the final report. So that's why we had decided that any late submission on the midterm report won't be, maybe some exceptions, but I don't think we can do that. Before the final report, you will have a final presentation that is the 17th of November. It's mandatory that everybody is present. The people that are remote, I guess they will have to arrange on Skype. So we will give you more information about this when the time comes. The final report is by the 24th of November and is mandatory. We're trying to have two different approaches on this, and it's also according to the master's level and the bachelor's level. So let's continue here. So just some general aspects of the project. So the groups should be organized themselves to balance the workload for each member. So try to make sure that every single one of you contributes. Sometimes that's something that has happened in my experience, that if there is someone that does not understand the project and he just gets carried on, the weakest link actually doesn't help that much during the presentation, and that can hurt the final grade. So try to keep everybody updated on what you're doing, and then just go to your room and develop a project yourself and then show it to your friends. No, it's better to do it in a group. Try to build up on each other's strength. So the idea is that we don't want any conflicts between you, but try to solve it within the group if there is some conflicts, because we understand that sometimes, especially for remote students, it's hard to have meetings, hard to coordinate the work. And we will try to allow you to self-resolve these problems, and only in extreme cases, let's say when we see lack of cooperation for solving this, we will intervene. Bachelor's students must have at least the standard project report, which is just there is some more specifications on the website. Anyone of you have seen the project description that I uploaded today? Yeah. So there is a document that will have a lot more detail on this. But in general, the idea is that the master's group, which should encourage you to have a more formal scientific structure. So basically it's 10 to 12 pages, good scientific references, and also the requirements will be a bit higher for the master's students than the bachelor's. There are some of the topics here. So who has selected the first topic? Steganography forensics? Nobody here? The second one, reverse engineering? Nobody here? Okay. The third one, overview of digital forensics standards? Nobody here? So all the remote students got the first projects. Smartphones, you already told me? Yeah. So smartphones is a hot topic here. Anti-forensics techniques for internet crime? Good. Big data? Challenging digital forensics, cloud forensics, okay. Mobile malware forensics, okay, good. Encrypted devices, evidence, okay, good. So the idea is that for those who has not selected topics, you're not obligated to choose the first or the second topic where nobody raised hands. You can also come up with some new topics that you find interesting. We encourage you to work in a different area to the ones that have been selected, because we want to have variety. And we want you to try, we don't want a group of 20 people working on the same project. So that's basically the idea. So if you have new topics, you have the project proposal to present it. Even earlier, you have the initial submission, which is the title abstract, and I will provide feedback over your submission to see if your approach or your idea is actually fulfilling the requirements of the course. More on the project. I guess these are more like considerations that you should have when you're writing the report. So you should back up all your claims and document all assertions and results by providing academic references. It's important, since not many of you have experience in digital forensics, Google is your best friend, but we encourage you to use scientific references even for bachelor and master students. Of course, it's bachelor's students will have some projects that are more technical, so reference for websites will be allowed. So if, for instance, I need to know how to crack some device or something, and I have a reference in a website, that would be allowed. But if you want to have an approach that has been used, let's say, in Interpol or Europol, and then you see some scientific publication or part of the scientific references could be the textbook that we have. Any of you have access to this book? Good. Yeah. So I guess you will have a separate chapter talking about the book. Yeah. Okay. Really, this is a point that I don't want headaches. I want to be nice to all of you, but plagiarism is not allowed. This has been a topic of a lot of concerns in my past experience. But I'm pretty sure here in Norway you will have no problems with that. You will cooperate, plus not copy, because we encourage cooperation but not copy-paste, okay? And remember, all the mandatory tasks must be fulfilled. Even if it's just pass or fail, it should be fulfilled. We don't want people to come up the last day with a super nice report, but we didn't even see a proposal in the beginning. So if you want to get the project approved, you should fulfill all the mandatory tasks. The optional tasks, as Carl pointed out, will help you to get some valuable feedback from the teacher. So that's what we encourage you to have the optional task. And just again, the grade on the final report is the grade for all the projects and is 50% of the course. I guess with this, just continue.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Jan Willem. I have almost all of my background is academic. So I started a bachelor here at Gjøvik University College. And I continued with my master's where I did this exact same course, but then it was 5 credit. I specialized in digital forensics, and my master's thesis was about analyzing criminal network communication to then try to determine who is the leader in those, only based on the on their communication pattern. So I used Enron as a substitute for a criminal network, but 1 month? No, yes, 1 month before I delivered my master thesis, of course there was one leaked criminal network, so I couldn't redo all the work. Yes, I started on a PhD last August, so I have already one semester been a teaching assistant in this course. I have a bad story about one of the project's report. So there was also a bachelor group that only had bullet points with links as a reference list. Please don't do that. Be a little bit more thorough. Yes. So that was what I have done, and this is what I'm working on now. The current problem is that it is difficult to detect money laundering and fraud. It is difficult because they only represent a small fraction of the total amount of transactions in any one the financial system. So often these patterns cannot be identified by only one transactions, but rather multiple transactions. So that is why I'm into the network analysis. Yes, so my goal is to increase the efficiency and effectiveness of financial crime detection analysis, by then trying to combine my areas of religious interest, which is machine learning and network analysis, fraud and money laundering, to then make it easier to detect and analyze financial crime. Lecturers and teaching assistants are complex roles. We typically spend less time teaching. So, for example, I'm only at 25% teaching assistance, and in my other time, I'm also being a student in different courses. I'm also writing a research report, having deliveries in those also in those courses. I'm organizing a workshop, having to correct at the moment an exam from this this spring semester, and a lot of different things. However, I will always be available to you via email. I usually respond quicker within the office hours, but you can also visit me at A152 in the forensics lab. But there is no exact meeting room in that place, so we can maybe go somewhere else if you need to. On the right here, you have maybe heard this before, but you are really responsible for your own learning. So my suggestion is to use the first part of the semester to focus or prioritize school first, and then you eventually learn to balance work, social life, family, and all that. I forgot to mention Edgar will mostly be handling your projects, while I will be handling Carl will be handling the lectures, but I will be handling everything else. So if you have a problem within the group, then I'm usually the one first that you should contact, or any other questions. You can also use the Blackboard the discussion forum to ask questions.
Just a very important thing to say that we prefer if you have general questions to ask these questions to the forum, because everybody can benefit from the questions, but many people can have the same question. If you have specific questions, if you would speak in one of the
I can repeat it. So if you have a general questions that usually concern everyone, for example, what is the syllabus or a curriculum, then this is something that affects everyone, and you can ask it on Blackboard. More specific questions, as this person is not helping with project work, then you can contact me about that. Yes, so we have over 100 students, I think it was 113 students this semester, and it's a mix of bachelors and masters. So there is different courses on Blackboard, but we are only going to be using the master Blackboard room for everything. So that is IMT 4114. Yes, and there might be people that don't read the announcement. So if you are, if you know, for example, of other students that is not part of the master course, then they should contact me, and I will add them. I will leave with you some. So the readings, because we are going to emphasize that you learn, for example, presentation skills during presenting papers and projects. So I have been reading some books this summer, really, that I found interesting. And they are listed here. And you can download them as free as long as you are on the school network. And so you can, for example, use a VPN and then download the books for free. So for example, the first book will help you to then what should be in each section of a research paper. So this is particularly useful for master students. So I will wish you good luck.
Some time here. Okay. So, I don't know if it's the most interesting thing about me, but I am a dual United States New Zealand national. Before I moved to Norway, I lived in New Zealand for about 20 years. As you can see, I moved to New Zealand in the late 90s, and then I just moved to Norway a little over a year and a half ago. My PhD is not necessarily digital forensics. It's information science, applied mathematics in neuroscience and bioelectromagnetics. I have an MSW from Purdue. I've got degrees in mathematics, philosophy, electrical engineering, blah, 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 blah. Why is that important? Why am I here? Okay, well, maybe more germane to what it is that we're studying. Information security is part of what we're trying to develop here, a security of science, rather a science of security. So I do have some critical operations and security experience in my background. I served 4 years in the United States Air Force with a top secret clearance and PRP certification for access to nuclear weapons. I was stationed at the 90th Strategic Missile Wing in the United States Air Force, where we had 200 Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missiles, each one armed with 3 thermonuclear warheads. Now, with arms reduction, there's only 1 nuclear warhead. Later on in this lecture, I will talk a little bit about how we secured those nuclear weapons. And if you want to know what my place was in the nuclear chain of command, some of you might have seen this cartoon on XKCD. How many people read the XKCD online cartoons? Okay, so you might have seen this. And the original cartoon says, okay, so the engineer who installed the red button is actually at the top of the chain of command. When I was in the Air Force, I was tech support. for the red button in the chain of command. Here's a picture of a nuclear missile, and you can see on the right side of this picture, they're loading reentry vehicles onto what's called the bus. And I compare the two of them. You can see the people next to the reentry vehicles, which are these dark things here, and then that is at the top of the missile. So you can see it's a pretty large missile. And this is going to be tough because I usually like to walk around. So what we have here is the missile launch tube. The missile that you just saw is lowered down into this tube and stored in the ground. And the reason why I'm showing you this picture is I want you to see the door that covers the missile silo. This is how thick it is. It's about 600 millimeters thick, weighs over 100 tons. Very secure. Here's another picture. There's the missile launch tube. Here's the launch closure door. As you can see, it's sort of like shaped like almost like a weird kind of octagon, if you will. It has eight sides. Here you are looking down the launch tube. This is a overhead view of the missile silo launch facility. If you recall, I said there was a rectangular door that covers the missile silo, and you can sort of see it here. The reason why we're looking at this now is here is the fence that embraces the entire site, and the first line of security defense, the first door that you have to get through, is this chain link fence, which is locked with just a regular old lock, padlock. However, once you've moved in here, there's topside radar surveillance, so there is intrusion detection. If you just drive in here, radar surveillance will pick you up and it'll cause an alarm. Once again, here's the door that we use to cover the missiles. This here is the beginning of the personnel access system. Now, as I said, this is a huge door, but when you have to go and fix something that's broken, you don't want to open this door every time because it takes forever. It's much easier if you want to fix something that's broken to have a small hatch that people can get into. So here is what's called the A circuit. That's the launch closure door. This is the personal access hatch. Once again, there's the personal access hatch. And when it's opened, you can see that there are several people, and this gives you a sense of scale about the size of that hatch. This hatch weighs about a ton, and it's anywhere from 400 to 600 millimeters thick. Now this shows you what is called the A circuit and the access hatch. And the reason why we want to see that is this is the first locked door that you have to open in order to access the missile silo. There's actually a sequence of three safes that you have to open in order to get into the missile silo. The first one is called the A circuit, and here you can see there's a combination lock on there. You can see how thick this is. And then once you've taken this A circuit out of this hole in the ground, it gives you access to a locking bolt, which you can just sort of see. And when you have access to the locking bolt, you can withdraw it to remove it from this latch here so that you can open the door. And then once that door is open, you can start lowering equipment down into the hole. However, you have to wait a little bit before you can do that because inside the hole is yet another safe. So first we have a safe that's steel about this thick. Then we have a door that's concrete and steel that's about this thick. And now we have a door that is this thick. This is the last door. It's called the B plug. So we got a sequence of three doors. When you work in security, you're going to have these different levels of access. You're going to have doors and safes. You're going to have nested security. Now, one of the things that I wanted to point out here is something called the Starfish Prime ABM test in 1962. How many people have heard of EMP, electromotive pulses? Okay. So what they accidentally discovered during the Starfish Prime experiment is if you detonate a nuclear weapon at an altitude of about 400 kilometers, what you're going to do is generate this massive EMP pulse that covers millions of square kilometers and can destroy electronics. The picture that we see here is a picture of this nuclear detonation from Hawaii. This is not a picture in the daytime. This is a picture at night. That's why you see all the lights on here and this thing that sort of looks like a sun in the sky. Well, once they realized that detonating nuclear weapons in space can cause EMP damage, they realized that You needed to harden the missile silos. Otherwise, if you were trying to defeat an adversary's nuclear deterrent system, all you needed to do was detonate one nuclear weapon within eyesight of their nuclear missile silos, and the EMP pulse would scramble all the electronics. So in order to shield the electronics, what you have to do is you have to enclose the nuclear missile system inside of a conductive shell. Why am I bringing that up? Well, if you're not keeping up with your maintenance or your updates, then you are creating security vulnerabilities. And that's not just for computers. That is a general security rule. What we have here is a security vulnerability because of all this corrosion around the primary access hatch. If you look here, you can see a dark band. This is a gasket that is molded in order to form a conductive seal around the access hatch. But if you're not keeping up with your maintenance, if you're allowing corrosion, if you're not keeping up with your updates, then you're creating a security vulnerability. That's why I wanted to talk about that. And layers of security. So you got the lock fence, you got the A circuit door, and the A circuit door, if you're going out there to fix something as the team chief, you don't have the combination to that door. Your armed guard has the combination to that door. Then you open the PAH, and then you open the B circuit. You as the team chief get the B circuit. How many people have heard of Edward Snowden? Edward Snowden. Yeah, everybody's heard of Edward Snowden. Why was he able to do the things that he did? What was the security breach there? He was one person who had access to everything. So one of the things that we did in nuclear weapons is we made sure that no single person can do anything. In order for any critical operation to proceed, there had to be two people present. Yeah, I've left a lot of stuff out. Okay. Well, besides that, I also have a Department of Energy Q security clearance. I did some classified and unclassified research at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Now we're starting to get into some of the work experience that is more germane to the work that I do here. I did some research in applied machine learning using something called CNLSNets. How many people have already had some machine learning and know what a radial basis function network is? Okay. I believe that the data science is one of the required courses or one of the recommended optional courses. You'll be able to learn about some of those aspects here. Sometimes the CNLS nets are connectionist nonlinear spline networks. Sometimes they're called connection normalized local spline networks. Who cares? Well, at some point you might when you take the data science course. We also did some research in the nuclear nonproliferation technology, using what was called the Blackbeard instrument package aboard the Alexis satellite. Now, this picture here is not of a weapon being released, even though it kind of looks like it. This is Orbital Systems L-1011, and this is a Pegasus launch vehicle. And essentially, this is a $23 million space launch system. Inside, we have a 400-kilogram satellite that is going to be placed in orbit. That satellite was the Alexis satellite, which contained the Blackbeard package, which was testing technology that we're going to use for the Forte, the fast onboard recording of transient events, or EMP detection. And if you recall, I said that nuclear detonation creates an EMP pulse. Well, for nuclear nonproliferation research, it would be good if we had satellites up in the air that were detecting EMP pulses, and that would tell us where nuclear detonations were taking place. That's a picture of the Alexis satellite. Let's see. I also did a little counterterrorism research and training at the Los Alamos. I highly recommend Professor David Rappaport's Four Waves of Modern Terror. It's an excellent theoretical overview of the thing that we call terror and the fact that right now we're in a jihadi wave, but that's not the first wave of terror. The first wave of global terror was the anarchist wave, followed by the anti-colonial wave, followed by the new left wave. We are currently in the jihadi wave. Who knows when it's going to end, but after it does end, we can probably expect another wave of terrorism. In order to understand the phenomena of terror, you need to understand its history. Let's see. more critical applications. I did some flight test engineering in Allied Signal Aerospace. I also did some product development engineering. That was fun. That was fun and more dangerous than I realized at the time. I also did some, security and access control system work for West Tech, command center operations. Other experience, I have some programming experience developing a voice over internet protocol application back in 1998. If I knew then what I know now, I would be rich. I did some embedded firmware for 8051. Who knows what an 8051 is? All right. They're everywhere. They are everywhere. I actually worked mainframe computer operator. This was going way, way back when, 4 megabytes of RAM cost $500,000 US. And I taught path mathematics at Purdue, and I survived the zombie holocaust. Well, actually, I was in a movie about surviving a zombie holocaust. My work here at NTNU. All right, so, as I said, I'm working in machine learning applications and digital forensics. When I came here, I was working with Økokrim, the Norwegian Authority for the Investigation of Environmental and Economic Crimes. And the cases that they are essentially investigating are extremely complex. They don't investigate hundreds of cases a year. They might have 10 cases on their book in any year. And in that case, they could have terabytes and terabytes of data. The kinds of cases that they're investigating are on par with the Enron case. How many people have heard of the Enron case? Okay. So one of the things that we're trying to do is expedite these digital investigations by creating these new tools that can analyze the data and guide the investigators, telling them, okay, here is some interesting relationships. That's one of the other reasons why Jan William Jensen is doing his research into social network analysis. If you were to analyze the Enron data, look at the social networks that are being formed, it would give you some insight into the criminal conspiracies and who is participating in them. The most recent research that I've done, well, I've supervised with some master's students, is topic modeling. We've used the Enron email corpus, and we've also done some topic modeling for cyber threat intelligence. And what topic modeling is, it is what is called an unsupervised machine learning algorithm that can analyze a tremendous amount of data and estimate the topics that are being discussed. Everybody who has heard of the Enron problem, though, is probably familiar with what the idea was. It was like a bookkeeping scandal, right? Enron was taking some of their liabilities and shoving it off the books and making the company look more profitable than it was. So when we did this experiment using topic modeling, and we applied it to the Enron email corpus, of course we were expecting to see some of the topics discussed having to do with the bookkeeping scandal. What surprised me was that another topic came out which reminded me of another thing that Enron was involved in. How many people have heard of the California energy crisis? All right. So when we analyzed the Enron email corpus, besides the topics having to do with the accounting scandal, we saw one topic that suggested the California energy crisis. I completely forgot about that, and when I saw that result, that is what convinced me that topic modeling is one of the ways to go for this research. Right now, we also have a big data hardware platform where we have 40 Xeon cores, we've got 440 gigabytes of RAM, over almost 200 terabytes of hard disk drive, and I said that, that's all well and good, but we need to upgrade it with some GPU crunching. The course book. Okay, so we are using Introduction to Digital Forensics, written by one of our faculty members, Andre Arnes. It is available at SIT. So if you don't already have a copy, you can probably get one at SIT. I think they've got about 40 copies on hand. Otherwise, they can ship the book here, or they can ship the book to you if you're not here for the remote students. Andre has specifically ask for your feedback on the book. If you find some errors that we've missed, please let us know. If you have some suggestions for making the book better, please let us know. And this is as good a time as any for a break. We're at 2 o'clock. We've been at this for 45 minutes. So let's come back at 2:15. Does anybody know if there's somewhere nearby that I can get a cup of coffee?
Yeah,
in the cafeteria. In the cafeteria? Cool.
Thank you. this each. So the overflowing master groups, do we need to take the bachelor?
If you're a master, you should be in a master group. If there's
I'm already in a group, but I'm wondering about the presentation. There's no spots left on the M1, M2, M3.
Contact Ian William and let him know that you need a spot.
Okay.
Thank you.
resume. See if this works. All right, the course contents. So in the lectures, I'll cover some of the course book and some other stuff. You are responsible for all of the material in the book. Even if I don't specifically mention in a lecture, you might see it on the exam. These lecture slides, all the lecture slides, will be made available on Blackboard. We will endeavor to get them up before the class starts, because I know many students like to download the slides and then annotate them with notes during the lecture. The exam will be a written exam. It will cover the lectures, it will cover some material from the labs, and it will also cover the additional reading. We'll talk more about the additional reading in a bit. The reading of the papers. Okay, so there is a list of papers. I believe there are 5 bachelor's levels paper, 5 papers for the bachelor's level students, and then 3 papers for the master's students. If you are a bachelor's student, you are only responsible for the 5 bachelor's level papers. If you are a master's student, you are responsible for the 5 bachelor level papers and for the 3 master level papers. So there's about 8 papers. If you start reading them now and me read about 1 paper a week, you'll have plenty of time to do all the reading. Some of the papers I found were relatively easy to follow. Some of the ones, especially that go into some very deep mathematics, I had to dig a little more on. As I said, the final exam can include questions from the papers. Those questions will not include mathematical derivations. Your group, the one that you're doing the project with, will also pick one of the papers, and you will give an oral presentation on one of the papers. The groups, they're limited to about 4 to 6 students. We want to keep the bachelor students and the master's students separate, and we want to keep the remote and the local students separate. So the group that you join should be a group that has the affinity of yourself. So if you are a remote master's student, then your group should be all remote master's students. If you are a local bachelor's student, then your group should be all local bachelor's students, and so on. And as you can see, we have this taxonomy here where we've got the BL, BR, ML, and MR. So join a group with your class and local or remote status and register on the Blackboard. Excuse me for a sec. Yeah! All right, that was a Chevy Chase sneeze. There we go. That one worked its way through. Chevy Chase sneeze. How many people have seen Community? All right. If you haven't seen Community, I highly recommend it. It's hilarious. How many of you have seen Rick and Morty? Okay, if you like Rick and Morty, you'll like Community, because the same guy who did Rick and Morty, he did Community. A few other rules. As I said, don't mix the bachelor's and master's students. Don't mix remote and local. Remote students must be physically present for the presentations. Definitely for the final presentation for your project. Maybe not for the oral presentation for the paper. We're still trying to figure that out. But so far, if you are a remote student, plan to be here in person for your presentation. We might let you do it by Skype, but right now, plan for the worst, hope for the best. Okay, we reserve the right to adjust the size and composition of groups, but we'll only do that under extreme circumstances. We will allow small groups if you ask us nicely and you have a good reason for it. Here's the list of papers. So the 5 bachelor papers, we have a paper on error, uncertainty, and loss in digital evidence. Well, I'm not just going to read the titles. You can see them there. Some of these papers, the research that was done here at NTNU, like the practical use of approximate hash space matching in digital investigations, that's something we did here. Identifying malware using cross-evidence correlation, I think we also did that one here. Let's see. The Trojan Horse Defense in Cybercrime Cases. This is a seminal and important paper. So even if you're a bachelor's student, I still recommend that you read that paper. And so on. Oh, the last one, the Constructing Bayesian Networks for Criminal Profiling of Limited Data. That's the one that gets into some pretty nasty mathematics. Let me know if you need some additional help with that. I can point you to some better papers that give you some of the background. The paper presentation dates. So, on the date of the third lecture, which I believe will be the 2nd of October, I believe it will be that day. I am not 100% sure because they keep changing the schedule on us. So check the time plan. The Bachelor's 2s and Bachelor's 3 groups will give their oral presentations on their papers. Then the week of Lecture 4, we have the B5 and M1 groups, and so on and so forth. As you can see, beginning with Lecture 3, we will have presentations during every lecture. That'll take up like about the last hour of the lecture. Why are we making you do this? Why are we making you work in groups? Well, as information security professionals, you will need to work in teams. You will need to give presentations to stakeholders on your findings. This is going to give you a chance to develop those skills that you will need in your professional life. And if you're not going on to work as a professional information security person, if you're going on to a PhD, these skills will help you with that as well. Okay, so as I said, the final exam can include questions about the papers. And your groups will be giving oral presentations on one of the papers. Recommended courses of action. Now, these slides are available on Blackboard. So when you see these links here, you don't have to write them all down now. You can get the links when you download the slides from Blackboard. So you got to join a group. You need to join a group for your project, and that's the same group that you'll be using for the paper. You'll be selecting the paper, selecting the project, you will work, and then there is some unknown connection between that and profit. I think we have underwear gnomes amongst us. The lab week. Okay, Jeff Hamm, he works for Mandiant FireEye. He is actually right now working on an incident. Hopefully, he will be finished with that incident in time to join us the October, I think it's the first full week of October when we have our lab. If he's not available, then Yan William will lead the lab. But the lab that Yan William leads is designed by Jeff Hamm, who is a professional with a long experience in security incident response. It'll be a day-long lab, 4 days over a week period. It'll be a practical application of digital forensics principles and tools. It'll be available by live stream, and yes, the material covered by the lab can be on the exam. Okay, so both the written exam and the projects are graded, and the total grade will be averaged according to the NTNU formula. Right now, it's a 50-50 split. The exam will count for 50% of your grade. The project will count for 50% of your grade. The presentations are pass-fail, and as I understand it, if you do not have a presentation set up, if you fail the presentation, you cannot get credit for that part of the course. So, pass your presentations. Show up. If you're a distance student, that should be okay. One of the reasons why I'm sitting here talking into the microphone and looking, well, not actually looking at the camera, but oriented towards the camera is so that we can stream this material for the remote students. These lectures are supposed to be recorded, the slides are supposed to be in synchronization, and everything should work according to clockwork. We'll see how that goes. This is the approximate schedule. Okay, today we have the introduction. The second session will be on the 18th, and it will be the computer forensics lecture. That will probably be given by Andrei Shagalaganov, because I will be in Groningen for the kickoff of the Essential Project. The computer forensics section in the book, the chapter 5, that was written by Jeff Hamm, who will teach the digital forensics lab. That means that chapter 5 and that lecture are prerequisites for the lab week that follows. And instead of having that lecture on the same week as the lab week, we want to have it at least 2 weeks in advance so you have time to digest the material. The third lecture will be on the law, which will include the Cybercrime Convention. That chapter was written by a professor at PHS, the Politihochschulen, the Police Academy. She was also a senior prosecutor for Ökokrim. And why do we need to study that? Well, we need to know what evidence really is in order for us to find it and safeguard it. We need to know what it is and what it isn't. And as I said before, starting with the third lecture, we will have the student paper presentations. And here we go. Lab week will be from the 3rd of October to the 6th of October. See the blackboard for specific locations and hours. The fourth lecture will be on the forensic process and forensic readiness. Chapter 2, which is on the forensic process, that was written by a security architect for the Central Bank of Norway. Chapter 4, forensic readiness, that was written by a cyber risk service manager at Deloitte. And as you can see, more paper presentations. The fifth lecture, this looks like a somewhat older version of some of the lecture notes. So we have the schedule change. The fifth lecture will be given on the time shown on time plan, not necessarily on the one that we have here on this lecture slide. So the fifth lecture will be on chapters 6 and 7, which will be mobile and embedded forensics, as well as internet forensics. Chapter 6 on the mobile and embedded forensics was written by a senior engineer in digital forensics at Kripos. Kripos is the Norwegian National Criminal Investigation Service. If you work here on your master's degree and you give a master's presentation at the Ars Forensica Kripos workshop in June, you will have an opportunity to tour the Kripos hardware laboratory. And that's really cool. I mean, they have some equipment there that just makes your mouth water if you're any kind of a technophile like I am. They have equipment that can essentially slowly shear off the ceramic cover for chips. Essentially, it ablates it with a laser blast, slowly wearing it down until you can get access to the circuitry underneath. And then they can hack into the circuitry of the chips themselves. Just amazing. And then Chapter 7 is a senior engineer at the Norwegian Defense, and he's also an advisor at Kripos. As a matter of fact, the people who wrote Chapter 6 and 7 are currently working on PhDs here at NTNU. And then again, Week 5, we have more student paper presentations. Week 6, well, we're going to have maybe some computational forensics. This is the lecture that is not mandatory for the bachelor's students, but it is mandatory for the master's. But even though it is not mandatory for the bachelor's students are still welcome to attend. And then the last week, we have the student project presentations, and then the final exam is currently scheduled for December 15th. So that was essentially a rough course schedule. Some of the dates have been changed. Deadlines will be announced on Blackboard. You'll be able to receive feedback on your project from Edgar. Previous projects that have been excellent have gone on and been developed for publication in scientific venues. That might happen with some of the projects this year. We don't know, but we'll see. Okay. Now, there are changes in this course. We might have a few rough patches here and there. The book is relatively new, so the book has just recently been published. It's been through a couple of alpha and beta tests. We think it is the perfect exemplification of digital forensics. However, you will be going through it in more detail and scrutiny. Please let us know if you find errors or things that we can improve. We will encounter a few problems along the way. We'll figure them out. Always remember, those friendly words on the front of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, don't panic. And here we go again with the same slide. Like I said, a few hitches along the way, no worries. Okay, I have another presentation where we'll start getting into forensics. Okay, so the science of forensics has a very long history. We can even trace it all the way back to ancient Greece. Archimedes. You've probably heard a little bit about the story of Archimedes. He sat down in his bathtub, saw that the level of water rose, then ran out, naked down the street, shouting, "Eureka, Eureka, I have it, I have it." Why? Well, he realized the way he could do his forensic test for the king. You see, as part of a tribute for the king, one of his vassals gave him what was supposed to be a solid gold crown. And the king was kind of suspicious that maybe the crown wasn't solid gold. And he asked Archimedes to test it without destroying it. So Archimedes was trying to figure out, how can I test this crown to see if it's solid gold without taking it apart? And then he realized that when he lowered himself into his bath, the displacement of the water and the fact that he could float meant that there was a relationship, that the volume of the crown would displace the amount of water that coincided with the volume of the crown. So he could figure out how much space the crown would fill. And since he knew how much space the crown could fill, he could also weigh the crown and figure out what its density was. And he could compare that with the density of gold. So that was one of the first examples of forensic science or forensic analysis. Modern criminal forensics probably started about 2,000 years later in the 8th century AD. It's been well integrated into Western culture, especially pop culture. The first Sherlock Holmes novel, A Study in Scarlet, integrated forensics. And now you're probably familiar with the multiple CSI TV series. First there was Las Vegas, then there was Miami and New York, and now there's CSI Cyber. If you watch any of these shows and you know anything about the science that they're talking about, you know that they're getting it wrong. Okay, so what are forensics? Well, it is the utilization of scientific methodology and techniques, thank you very much, to establish factual answers to legal questions. This is the heart of forensics, establishing factual answers to legal questions. And the way that we do that is we use science. The questions that we want to answer are often the 5WH questions: who, what, where, when, how, why, etc., etc., etc. Why are these questions important? Well, we wanted to figure out what happened, who did it, how they did it, where did it happen, and so on and so forth. In a criminal act, we use the science to assist or enable law enforcement. However, some of us won't be working for law enforcement. We might be working for enterprise IT, and we'll be analyzing something called an incident. When we do that, we're assisting or enabling enterprise IT security and recovery. And this is one of the, to me, one of the more interesting aspects of digital forensics, that digital forensics for criminal investigations and digital forensics for incident response have many of the same tools, but often the goals are in contradiction to each other, and we'll see more about that in a bit. Where do we get these methods? Well, in biology, we have bugs, seeds, plants, and DNA. In medicine, we have osteology, which is the study of bones, dentistry, pathology, etc. And in physics, we've got material sciences, mechanics, and so on. With biology, we can use the infiltration of insects into a corpse to determine the time of death. Or we can use the distribution of plants and seeds to figure out where the location of the crime was. With medicine, we can study the bones of a victim and maybe figure out their identification. Same thing with their dentistry. And we can also figure out the cause of death. One of the other popular TV shows is something called Bones. I am not familiar with the science there, but I'm guessing they don't always get that right either. And with physics, how fast was the car traveling at the time of collision? If you've ever seen police investigating a traffic accident, you'll see them walking around with devices to measure distances. And they can use that to figure out how fast cars were going by how far they traveled after the collision. But even beyond that, they can even determine whether the headlights were on or off at the time of collision, because the temperature of the glass at the time of collision has something to do with the shatter patterns. We can also get some forensics from chemistry and geology. So, chemistry. Well, how drunk were you? I tell you, that sign just jumped right out in the middle of the road. It attacked me. Or how about the composition of explosives? Why do we care about the composition of explosives? Well, it helps us to determine which group planted the bomb. Post-earthquake forensics. Did the building collapse because it just shook too hard? Or did the building collapse because it wasn't built up to standard? Mathematics, statistics in particular, plays a key role. To me, you can't do science without mathematics. To me, science is the discipline of measurable differences. So we use statistics, combinatorial theory, probability theory, and so on. One of the realms where we use statistics is determining whether a DNA match is significant. There's a 1 in 60 million chance of matching a random person. Why is that the case? How is it possible? I mean, are DNA strands completely unique for each person? Probably. But there's no way for us to test an entire DNA strand. So what happens with DNA testing is we look for certain specific markers. Instead of testing the entire strand, we might test less than 1% of it, but the 1% that we test has these markers that are specific for each individual person. And the chances of having a match on all N markers for two different people when they're not even related to each other is this 1 in 60 million, and that number is determined mathematically. Okay, what about false positives, especially with DNA matching? Can you even get it? Oh, yes. There is this famous case called the Phantom of Heilbronn, and I do not know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. The Bavarian police thought that they had a serial killer because her DNA was turning up at crime scenes all over the place. But what turned out to be the case was that the swabs that they were using to test the DNA had been pre-contaminated by one of the workers at the manufacturing facility to create these swabs. So this phantom that people thought was a serial killer was actually this innocent woman who was just boxing up the swabs and shipping them out. But because her DNA was contaminating the swabs, her DNA was showing up in the analysis. So just because you get a positive doesn't mean it's correct. This is one of the most important aspects, not just of forensic science, but of science. Always have a healthy skepticism with respect to what your tools are telling you. Check and double check. Especially when someone's life depends upon it. And then, of course, computer science, which is why we're here today. Okay, let's take a look at a short history of forensic science. We can go back to the late 18th, early 19th century for forensic toxicology with Matthew Orfila, who was considered the father of forensic toxicology. Then later on, in the late 19th, early 20th century, we have the personal identification, the beginning of measuring bodies to figure out who this person is, which leads us to fingerprint analysis. Then we've got the science of investigations. And it all comes together. Oh, no, that's not Locard. And then, of course, we've got the document examinations. So forensics covers a variety of different fields. As we mentioned before, we've got biology, we've got mathematics, we've got geology, and the history reflects it. We've got forensic toxicology, we've got personal identification, we've got document examination. And then getting more and more modern, going into the first realm of biology, where we have blood group of blood stains. Before we had DNA testing, we had blood types. And what you could do with the blood type, it wasn't so much that you could say, oh, this person did it. You could say, well, no, this person could not do it because the assailant had blood type O and the suspect here is blood type A. There is no way that the suspect could be the assailant because the blood type doesn't match. And finally, we have Locard, Edmund Locard, who in some respects is the true father of all forensics. He gave us what is called the Locard principle, or Locard's exchange principle. And essentially what that means is anytime two things meet, they make an exchange. So The perpetrator is going to leave traces of himself on the victim or the crime scene where he committed the crime. And then the victim or the crime scene will be leaving traces of itself on the perpetrator. And this is the foundation of physical forensics. So, for example, maybe the fibers from a carpet that was found at the murderer's house is on the victim's clothing. That by itself is not going to be enough. But if you find multiple aspects of unique physical evidence that connects the victim and the murderer, that's going to strengthen your case. Maybe instead of fibers, we're talking about sand at a beach, and so on and so forth. Okay, so it works in the physical world. How well does it work in the ethereal world of e-contact, of digital forensics? Well, it does work to some extent, because with intrusion detection or with incident response, when you're working through the timeline, when you're analyzing a suspect's computer, you are looking for traces of the crime. Drive through a city with your cell phone on. Every tower that you drive by is going to leave a trace on your cell phone. Sorry, mobile phone. Every cell tower that you drive by that registers your phone, it will leave a trace on your phone, and your phone will leave a trace in the logs of the cell tower. Okay, so what are some of the ways that investigations can be complicated? Well, with respect to who? There are all the persons who are relevant to the investigation, including the suspects, the witnesses, the victims, sometimes even the investigators. And it's not necessarily going to be self-evident. Let's say someone is missing. Well, are they missing because they're a victim, they've been murdered, and their body has been disposed of? Or are they missing because they're a perpetrator? They committed the crime and they got out of Dodge. Victims might be in a faraway country. Internet crimes. Maybe there aren't any victims that you can identify per se, or they might be uncooperative. If a criminal is a victim of a crime committed on him by a member of his gang, then that criminal is not going to cooperate with the investigation into that crime. The where can be complicated too, especially when it comes to digital forensics. The where is the location of the crime, but it can also be other related locations. For example, if the crime was committed in Oslo, and the suspect says, well, I was in Jervik at the time, those are two locations relevant to the crime. Could the suspect have gotten to Oslo and returned to Jervik in time? And of course, there's the aspect of jurisdiction. And this is also very important when it comes to digital crimes, because we have internet crime, which can cross many jurisdictions, which is one of the reasons why we have the Cybercrime Convention in Europe. For example, let's say the United States currently wants to access Microsoft servers because they're owned by Microsoft. But Microsoft refuses because, hey, the servers aren't in the United States. They're over in Ireland. That's another country. You don't have jurisdiction over there. So as far as I know, the United States and Ireland do not have any kind of analog to what we have here in Europe with the Cybercrime Convention. You will study the Cybercrime... No, I take it back. You won't study the Cybercrime Convention. You will read about it in the textbook. I highly recommend that you download a copy of the Cybercrime Convention and read it. It's not terribly long. More investigation complications. What? That's supposed to be the exact description of what happened with all the details correct, which is much more difficult when it comes to computers. Why does it have to be exact? Well, if you're doing incident response, maybe it doesn't have to be exact. Maybe it just has to be accurate enough so that you can return the enterprise to its original state before the intrusion. But if you're in a criminal investigation and you're submitting evidence to the court, you have to have an exact description. You have to be precise. And then the when. I already talked about this a little bit. The when and the time are important for things like establishing alibis. Timestamps. Now, in digital forensics, timestamps can be your friends, or they can be your enemies. If the timestamps have not been changed, then you can wade into them and you can find the timeline for a computer crime. If the timestamps have been changed, they can lead you astray. How do you know whether a timestamp has been changed or hasn't been changed? This is one of the subtle minutiae of digital forensics. You could have bad timestamps because of bad sync. You could have bad timestamps because of something called time stomping. Time stomping is when someone has deliberately changed the timestamps. But usually you can detect that. Assuming for the sake of argument that the timestamps have not been modified, then you can use them to establish accurate timelines and give you the timing of events. This is one of the reasons why when you're doing incident response, you look at computer logs. Why? Why did this happen? The motive. Why did they do this or why did they do that? Usually, if you don't know who, if you can figure out why, that will tell you the who. Motive means an opportunity. The why is the motive. With respect to a criminal procedure, the why also helps you establish what's called intent. Did the person have a criminal intent? That can be the difference between being found guilty or found not guilty. Because in most legal jurisdictions, the frame of mind of the person who committed the crime is also germane in determining whether they were guilty or not. Do they have what is called a guilty mind? In the United States, I think it's called mens rea. I don't know if they call it here. How? Okay, this is important both in the criminal and also the incident response realm. How they did it is important because you have to figure out what computers are compromised. And you also have to figure out how to safeguard the system in the future. In incident response, the how is often the most important question. Because you have to answer the how, you have to figure it out in order to restore the system, to get the enterprise back online. You want to know how they got in, you want to know what it is they took, how did they take it, how did they exfiltrate it, and how to stop it from happening again. Criminal investigations. Purpose-oriented process to determine whether a crime has been committed or not. Because if there hasn't been any crime, our work is done. This once again points to the difference between an incident response and a criminal investigation. An incident response might not point to a crime, but it could be something that your enterprise has to figure out and fix in order to get back online. Maybe no one hacked you. Maybe this was just Microsoft, blue screen of death. Who did what? Who done it? Did the person act with the necessary level of guilt? What was their intent? Why they did it is important. Prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, sure, it seems like my client might have committed the murder, but in reality, the Martians duplicated his body and it was this doppelganger who committed the crime. I guess that's sort of possible, but that doesn't create a reasonable doubt. Okay, the scientific method, it's data-driven and hypothesis testing. A good scientific theory accounts for all of the data. If you've got two scientific theories that both account for all the data, the simpler theory is the one that you take. So, in hypothesis testing, especially when we come to criminal investigations, we're looking for evidence that either confirms our theory of the crime, confirms this person is guilty, or it refutes the theory of the crime. It exonerates this person. We know that the assailant had blood type O, but the person, the suspect that we have in custody, has blood type A. That is evidence that refutes our theory of the crime. We don't have the right suspect in custody. Falsifiability. This is one of the most important aspects of science. When you test a scientific theory, if it passes the test, then essentially you haven't proven the theory. You have validated it. You have given it support. A scientific theory is never proven. There is the fact of gravity, and there is the theory of gravity. When I drop this pen and it falls, that is the fact of gravity. That cannot be disproven. The fact that the pen falls when I drop it is not science. It's just the way the world works. General relativity, the curvature of space-time, the way that the Earth's mass curves the space-time around it so that this pen falls down to geodesic to the table, that is the theory of gravitation. That can be invalidated. That can be falsified. That is the difference between science fact and science theory. Karl Popper was a great philosopher of science. He's the one who proposed the concept of falsifiability in science. And what it means is, whatever your theory is, if there is no way to test it and falsify it, if you can't find, even in principle, a way that your theory can fail, it's not science. So astrology is not science. You can write an astrological profile of someone for one star sign. You give it to a person with a different star sign, and they read it, and they say, yeah, that's me. That's an example of something that cannot be falsified. So if I were to say that I have a theory of gravity where I don't need space-time curvature, I could have invisible purple unicorns grab the pen and bring it down to the table. But there's no way to test it. That's not a scientific theory. So what does this have to do with criminal investigations? Well, there has to be a way for you to falsify your theory of the crime. Has to be a way to test it, because we always have a presumption of innocence. And the innocence with respect to the science, with respect to the language of science, is the null hypothesis. You have to have compelling evidence to force you to reject the null hypothesis. How many people have heard about hypothesis testing in statistical analysis? Okay, a few of you. Good. Presumption of guilt, null equals guilty. So if I were to say that this person I don't like, I know that they have sexual relations with animals, and if we had a presumption of guilt, there was no way in the world that they could prove that they're innocent. He could say, My wife and I have this great sex. We even have videos of us having great sex. I want to enter the videos into evidence. Well, that's very interesting, and we would like to see the videos. However, they do not prove that you don't like to have sex with animals. That's why we have to have a presumption of innocence instead of a presumption of guilt. Because you can't prove a negative. For example, let's say a controversial politician was accused of abusing children, and this often happens. There is no evidence in the world that he can submit that proves that he didn't abuse children. Okay, moving on, but let's take a break now, even though it's a few minutes early, because we're going to move on to something slightly different. So let's come back at 10 minutes after 3.
Database of carving up size basically. Exactly. I have a big force because I have I have earlier history.
Oh, okay.
It's myself, but it's not overkill, it's just a regular quiz, so it's right. Much lower level. But your work, it didn't involve any kind of investigation for the developing of the...
Well, that's just it. So one of the big problems we have in research in this field is getting our hands on realistic data.
Yeah.
Because all the good data is sensitive data. So all we really have is the Enron data. Now we have the Panama Papers. And that's really all that we have, I think, with respect to actual data that is related to crimes. So one of the things that we have Edgar here for is his PhD is in the simulation of financial crimes. And then this is one of the other aspects of the research that we're doing. So on the other end of the spectrum, we have the Oslo Police District,
yes,
which has hundreds, maybe thousands of cases.
Yes, but they're
all small.
Yes.
But because of the proliferation of modern technology, every case now has a digital component.
Yes.
So they might not have as few cases over, right? And the cases that they have might not be as big, but they might have just as much data that
yes.
they need to take care of. So can we build a platform that serves both? That's one of the questions that we're trying to answer.
Maybe, but of course you need the competence, because the average police officer doesn't have, they have a general training, but not the...
Well, that's the other reason. That's one of the other reasons why we're pursuing this research. We want to see if we can provide something called digital forensics as a service.
Yes.
So all the police officer has to do, the frontline police officer, just needs the amount of expertise to properly identify and collect the digital evidence.
And then
the analytics takes care of it.
Yeah, that's awesome. But it's still independent because the police is very strict. You need to have
absolutely
personal training, because if you go into court and they ask you and you can't support it, then it's lost.
Yes.
But did you ever have to stand up in court?
Oh, me?
And justify?
Oh, no. I'm not, so I'm a data scientist.
Okay.
I'm not a forensic investigator. Research and my career were actually bringing me in to talk about the tools I've developed.
Yes, that could happen.
That could happen, absolutely. Yes. I'm Carl, by the way.
Yeah, Berge.
Sir?
Berge.
Berge?
Yes.
Berge.
I'm not from China or something.
I wasn't questioning the name because it was didn't
no,
fit. It was because I was terrible with Norwegian names.
Yeah, but
okay.
Yeah, they don't get it.
I think there's another gentleman waiting to speak to me. So you might be able to get it as an ebook from Amazon.
But I mean from the library.
No.
Is it mandatory for the exam? This book?
The material in the book will be on the exam.
As exchange is quite expensive, really expensive.
Send me an email, explain the situation, and I'll see if I can get you something. But as far as I know, we're not allowed to give away free copies of the ebook, but if we can give copies of the physical book away. I honestly don't know, but I think everybody just wants to give away a copy of the book. But this is the first time I realized that maybe some of the exchange students need to have an e-version. And the e-version is usually only like $5. Might be able to sell it when you're done with it, but are you?
I'm only here through December, and I think the next course is next year.
Okay.
So
that's true. Okay. Send me an email. Send me an email. Carl.Leichter@NTU. It'll be on the slide. Send me an email, and then I'll pass along and find out whether I can do something.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You are. Let us continue with the hypothetical example, which shows the hypothesis-driven model for criminal investigation. So we start out with this incident report from the Metropolitan Police to the Oslo Police Department that a certain IP address has been found to be sharing images of the abuse of children. And the following comes from the master's thesis called Non-Technical Sources of Errors When Handling Digital Evidence Within Criminal Investigations. Okay, so we start with the basic investigation. And we identify the subscriber that corresponds to the IP address. We obtain a search warrant and an arrest warrant. The suspect is arrested. Digital evidence and digital devices are collected. They're able to store the content that we suspect. They're also able to connect to the internet. This is how we identified them as part of our collection process. We will discuss the forensic process at some point where we'll talk about things like identification, collection, etc. Okay, one of the first things that we do is we perform a bit-by-bit copy of all the digital archives. We analyze them, and then we find that there are abuse images, and we use those abuse images as evidence in the court. And the result is that the suspect is found guilty and sentenced to jail for 9 months. Okay, what would a hypothesis-driven investigation look like? Well, we start out with hypothesis 4, which means that the suspect has shared these illegal images. And hypothesis 4 corresponds to the crime that they were convicted of, and that's the 9-month jail sentence. But what are some of the other hypotheses? Well, maybe the suspect was in possession of the illegal images, shared them by accident. The suspect believed that they're only sharing legal porn. Or another hypothesis, the suspect had an open wireless network and someone unknown had shared the images. Or there hadn't been any sharing on the IP. A foreign law enforcement agency actually mixed up the IP addresses and the subscriber had not committed any crime, had not engaged in any kind of pornographic activities. 4 different hypotheses, 4 different ways of testing each hypothesis. You, as a digital investigator, would have to analyze the suspect's computer and rule out, falsify each hypothesis one by one, or confirm each hypothesis one by one. Once a hypothesis has been falsified, it can't be ruled back in. Once you figure out that the suspect has blood type A, when the assailant is known to have blood type O, that suspect can't be ruled back in. Okay, well, we've gone backwards with respect to the different hypotheses of the crime, from being guilty and sentenced to 9 months in jail to being not guilty of anything. But there's other ways we could go. There's hypothesis five, where the suspect had taken part in the production of the images. They ordered streaming of sexual abuse from another perpetrator in the Philippines. Or the suspect had actually committed the sexual abuse by himself. The suspect had committed the sexual child abuse himself and shared images of it. Or the suspect had access to many children which were abused, and he regularly shared images of his crime. Or the suspect is part of an organized network that is sexually abusing children and sharing images of it. They're selling pictures on the dark web. You, as an investigator, have to figure out which one of these hypotheses is valid. Because if H1 is the real hypothesis, and you have failed to gather evidence to validate H1, or you have failed to gather evidence to falsify H4, then you are responsible for sending an innocent person to prison. On the other hand, if you get a conviction on H4, but H8 really holds, then you've sent a person to prison for only 9 months when that person is part of an organized network that is sexually abusing children and sharing images of it, when that person should be going to jail for much more than 9 months. When you're analyzing a crime, you need to generate multiple different hypotheses and rule them out one by one based on the evidence, based on the data. This might also work if you are working in industry in intrusion detection. Maybe it's only one computer that has been compromised. Maybe it's hundreds of computers that have been compromised. Maybe it's 200,000 computers and every server has been compromised. You have to create these different hypotheses and test each one. You need to be thorough. Okay, part of the investigation is a crime reconstruction. The theory of the crime, if you will. Finding the exact steps and timing of the crime. Once again, we return to timelines. Another concept that has to be understood is something called evidence dynamics. If you're careful, there aren't many evidence dynamics in digital forensics. Sometimes there can be evidence dynamics, though, with respect to just physical evidence. Evidence dynamics means how does the evidence change over time? Can the evidence disappear? Can it decay? Can it be destroyed? Can it be augmented? Can it be moved, regardless of whether you intended to do this or not? Dynamics, how things move and change. Poorly stored DNA can degrade. A wireless access point log on a phone can change as you move the phone around. It's important because things change as we observe them. This is especially true in memory forensics. As time passes, other things happen. Now, in incident response, you are going to be torn between getting the enterprise back up as quickly as possible and destroying the evidence so you can figure out what happened, because the two are usually not compatible. In digital forensics, there are many subfields. We have the network forensics, where we're studying network dynamics, network logs, and so on and so forth. The storage forensics, how our data is stored on hard drives, file access systems, and so on. Device forensics. How do you hack into a phone? Internet forensics, which is not necessarily the same thing as network forensics, and so on. Okay, now I was talking to someone earlier, and we were talking about the differences between OCLCRIM digital forensics and maybe the Oslo Police digital forensics. And I said, well, chances are, even though OCLCRIM only has about 10 or 15 active cases, and the Oslo Police District might have maybe 100 or so active cases. In both ways, they might have the same amount of data to store. Because with the OCLCRIM cases, each case might have terabytes of data. But with the Oslo Police District cases, each case might have 100 gigabytes of data, because you might have a mobile phone, or a tablet, or a computer, all three attached to each one. So just about every case today is going to have a digital component. mobile phones. Might be as simple as using coded SMSs in a drug deal. GPS routing might be useful evidence. Some cars these days actually record the GPS, so sometimes the evidence won't be stored in a phone, it'll be stored in a car computer. Maybe your suspect was surfing the internet for information about the crime, looking for specific information about how to do things like dispose of a body. You check his browser cache. Yes, question.
When they accumulate all the evidences, do they confiscate the equipment or do they replicate the data or create another copy of the data?
That's a very good question. Usually with respect to incident response, they try not to seize the data because the enterprise needs to use the needs to use those computers to continue running the enterprise. So if you're running an incident response, you're not going to take the systems offline. With respect to a criminal investigation, it depends upon the severity of the crime. For example, if the clock is ticking and they think that maybe there's some kind of victim who could die, then they're going to take all the evidence and they're going to have a analyze it as quickly as possible. If it's maybe forgery, I don't know. So it's up to the investigator. What might happen is they might take a forensic copy, and what they'll do is they will compute a hash. So I seize a hard drive. I make a forensically sound copy of the hard drive. What I can do is I can compute the MD5 or the SHA-1 or the SHA-256 hash of the hard drive, the original hard drive and the copy, and then have some kind of certification that the two hashes match. And then I can give the original back because I've established the fact that I now have a forensically sound exact copy. That is a possibility. Okay, so let's say that your suspect has a browser history that shows that they were searching for body disposal methods that match the crime. That's evidence. As I said before, an automobile computer could have GPS evidence or could have evidence about how fast the car was driving. One of the most important things is that the frontline police have to learn how to preserve evidence. For example, I believe there's a case where a frontline police officer seized a phone, tried a few times to enter, guess the PIN, the phone locked up and wiped itself. That's considered a mistake. So we're going to go through some of the details in the course, but only to whet your appetite, because this is just introduction to digital forensics. There is a follow-on course, Digital Forensics 2. There's also Computational Forensics. So some of the important concepts, crime versus incident, which I've already discussed. Crime is, of course, where we have the police are investigating. The police are enforcing the law. They have special powers, special dispensations, and special rules. Whereas with an incident, it's a civilian setting, not the same set of rules. Now, if you are working for a company and you are supposed to cooperate with the incident response, and you choose not to cooperate, then the IT response team can't throw you into jail. However, that might be grounds for your dismissal. And it should be noted that in incident response, whatever it is that happened is often not reported as a crime. Even if it is a crime, it might not be reported as a crime. Why might that be? Yes? Exactly. Okay, crime versus incident. Some of the basic principles are in common, but there are differences, especially with respect to the goals. With the crime, the objective is to secure a conviction, which means that preserving the evidence integrity is the prime goal. Without evidence integrity, you have no evidence. Although I understand that some jurisdictions are more lenient than others. So in the United States, there are more severe consequences to perturbing evidence as opposed to maybe some other jurisdictions. So everything has to be kept as it is. You copied the hard drive, you make a forensically sound copy, and you use hashes to establish the fact that it is a true copy. With respect to an incident, though, what you're doing is you're not investigating a crime. You're not trying to secure a conviction. You're trying to manage the risk to the organization, the risk to the business, the risk to the assets. You have to preserve the operational integrity, preserve the reputation. You want to restore full operational functionality as quickly as possible, which means that you might have to do a clean build. You would never do this in a criminal investigation. In incident management, you might have security monitoring, where the security incident management and their own topics using their own processes, contexts, and objectives, which we're not handling in this book. That's a whole different realm. And as I said before, the goals and processes are in direct conflict with forensic principles and goals. The objective in incident response is to get the enterprise running again. The objective in a criminal investigation is to secure a conviction. And those two objectives are often in conflict. All forensics is after the fact. We do not have, what was it, the minority report, pre-crime. We can't do forensics before we know something has gone wrong. Of course, the things that we analyze, like network logs, they might have recorded what was occurring before the crime happened, but that helps us. In respects to digital forensics, we have to go through the logs of last week. Or we have to dig through backup tapes that could be many years old. Digital forensics can also be performed as it happens, especially with respect to network incident response. Okay, we've got these multiple different items in digital forensics. We've got devices, we've got media, we have objects. A device, of course, is going to be a physical object that stores and processes the data. Laptop, smartphone, the car computer. Now we're going to have the Internet of Things as well. The media is where we store the data. It will be a binary representation of digital data. And you need to know your computer architecture to know about all the different ways that it can store the data. So, for example, you might have non-volatile memory that is on the circuit board, and you might have non-volatile memory that has been added after the fact. So I've got a 128 gigabyte SD micro SD card in here, besides the, I think it's like 32 gigabytes of RAM that's built into the circuitry. You're going to work with a discrete collection of digital data, and this collection is going to be called digital objects. There's several digital objects in here. Or this could be the digital object. Let's see, the word file MISI contains? Okay, that's an interesting misspelling. Word files may contain many types of data. So a word file is a single file that can contain multiple types of data. You could have text, you could have images, you could have links, and so on and so forth. You could even have media, recordings of sound. Forensic soundness, I think I've mentioned this before. We need to ensure that our methods are forensically sound. What do we mean by that? That we don't perturb the evidence, that the collection of the evidence, the analysis of the evidence, doesn't change the evidence that we've collected or analyzing. So what that means is that by law in some countries, you have to follow specific methods and procedures that are consistent with observation, measurement, and experiment, and the formulation and testing and modification of hypotheses. Very rigorous standards. You will probably find, if you become a digital forensics investigator with the police, that besides all of these different tools, you're going to have a tremendous amount of paperwork that documents your processes, documents the steps, documents your measurements, and on and on and on. It's important, though, because that's how the scientific method works. You have to be able to prove that what you did is what you did, and given your methods and given the evidence to a completely different person, they can replicate your results. And when an investigation is forensically sound, it adheres to the digital forensic principles and processes that makes this replication possible. In the United States, there are very strict rules. So I think I mentioned this a little earlier. that if you've perturbed the evidence, if you have done anything wrong in the collection of the evidence or the analysis of the evidence, you can't get it into court. I understand that here in Norway, if you can convince the judges that, yes, there were a few minor incidents with respect to the evidence, but that doesn't change the fact that it is an accurate reflection of what happened, it might still be admissible. I'm no lawyer. I don't even play one on TV. The courts decide what is admissible here in Norway. Okay, there are two fundamental principles of forensic soundness. Evidence integrity. That is, that the evidence has to be preserved in its original form. But if you make any kinds of changes, then they have to be extremely well motivated and well documented. You have to explain exactly what you did, and you have to be able to say what the effect was on the evidence. The other one is the chain of custody. You have to be able to document every step of the way how the evidence was acquired, how it was controlled, how it was analyzed, how it was disposed of, from A to Z. Who did what? When did they do it? Why did they do it? What was the result? It all has to be documented. All this paperwork. Of course, might not actually be paper. You might be able to do it online, but I recommend making hard copies. What is digital evidence? Well, it's any digital data that contains reliable information which can support or refute a hypothesis. It is anything that you can use to reliably test the hypothesis. And after the test, the results of the test either support the hypothesis or it refutes it. And the hypothesis can be a hypothesis of the incident or the crime. Incident response, criminal investigation. What are some of the issues? Well, we've got layers of abstraction. So, there are various means of grabbing data out of the phone. You could grab the data out of the phone and show it just as bits, zeros and ones. That is the lowest level of abstraction. Or you could show it on what is called the file system level. How is the data stored in the file system? Or you could show it on the application level. Show the conversations on Twitter and things like that. Various different levels of abstraction. Which one is appropriate? It depends upon your application. That is one of my favorite sayings when I'm discussing data science. What kind of machine learning algorithm should you use? What kind of data pre-processing system should you use? What kind of features should you extract? Well, there's no one size that fits all. As a matter of fact, in data science, we have something called the no free lunch theorem, which says whatever is ideal for this application is not necessarily going to work for this application. There is no one size fits all. Your choices are going to depend on your application. In forensics, we often have to reconstruct everything, all the layers. And with respect to exonerating evidence, with respect to the evidence that the defense counsel are going to want, what you might consider to be irrelevant, they might say, well, how do you know that's irrelevant? It might be that this part of the evidence that you haven't analyzed, that's where the exonerating evidence is, and you should analyze that. So you might have to analyze everything, even if you think it's not relevant, simply because you need to show that you've been thorough looking for evidence that doesn't fit your theory. A fragment of a deleted file can be reassembled and the resulting word file interpreted to recover text from document. There's a tremendous amount of research and science behind that. It's very easy to recover something that's been deleted when all it has had is in the file access table said, all right, this is now available space to be used and it hasn't been used yet. But when that's been sitting around for a while and the header for the file has been overwritten and it's also fragmented, trying to recover those fragments and putting it back together into a Word document, that's a serious challenge. The hard drive layout, the file system semantics, file format semantics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these play a role in recovering data. Okay, metadata is a very important source of information, especially if it has not been tampered with. Metadata is data about data. You might have heard about metadata during the hearings in the United States about something called the PRISM program, where they were talking about, well, we're not actually looking at the emails, we're just looking about the to and the from and where they were going, the IP addresses, but we weren't really spying on people. We just wanted to know everybody that they were talking to. Well, sometimes that can be very important data. And it's not just about emails. It can also be about when a file was created. It can also be about when a photo was taken, where it was taken, what camera was used, and so on. Where was located GPS, exposure control. This can be a very valuable source of information in your investigation. Metadata can help you develop your timelines. And especially when metadata has GPS, it can also help you to figure out where things happen, not just in time, but in space. Some more issues. Error, uncertainty, and loss. You need to be able to quantify it. You need to be able to deal with it. You need to be able to report what your errors are, what your uncertainties are, what your losses are. Because if you don't, and then the defense lawyer says, well, did you compute this uncertainty? And you say you didn't, and they can prove that you should have, that will weaken your case. So you have to know about them, and you need to be able to control them. You need to be able to account for them. Because essentially, there might be times when you can't get rid of all error, but you might be able to minimize it within certain tolerances. How many people here have already heard of the Daubert standard? Okay, you'll learn about that in the digital forensic class. Quantifying error, uncertainty, and loss are an important part of the Daubert standard, which is a United States legal doctrine, which has been imported here in Europe, saying that when we use science to analyze evidence, that the science we use has to be good science. And how do we define that? Well, we use the Daubert standard. And part of that standard is to be able to quantify the error, uncertainty, and loss. So you've got to be able to understand it so you can correctly interpret the data. How accurate are the timestamps? How much accuracy do you need? What is your application? Are they correct? Have they been time-stamped? Are they local time or are they Zulu time? Is the geographical location accurate? Or is it just a placeholder for I don't know? That can be a problem. I'm not sure if I got a slide that discusses that. We'll see. Yes. So, in the United States, in the exact middle of the United States, there is a farm in Kansas that used to be subject to a tremendous amount of law enforcement activity because law enforcement agencies were told that the location of the crime was this farm in the middle of the United States. What they didn't know when they were raiding this farm and driving these poor people crazy was the fact that this is sort of like a default setting. When the IP mapping didn't know exactly where this location was, it said, well, it's in the United States, and there it is right there in the middle of the United States. So you have to always double check and make sure that, well, there's the location, yes, but is that the default location for the software? There's something called Null Island at 0 degrees latitude and 0 degrees longitude. The process. We're going to have a lecture about this, but this is so important we can look at it now. The forensics process starts with identification. You're at the scene of the crime. You're doing your incident response. You need to find out what systems are important in my investigation. What systems are important in my incident response, which ones need to be taken offline? Which pieces of evidence need to be seized and taken back? Which ones do I need to collect? And then after you've collected it, there's the examination. And the examination phase is, okay, I've got these digital repositories. Now I need to extract the data and put these things back together. I need to take the fragmented Word documents and put them in together into a single document. Then once you've got all the pieces put together, once you have all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, then you have to put it together. And then once you have the jigsaw puzzle together and you have your theory of the crime and you have the evidence that confirms the theory of the crime, then you need to be able to present it. Those are the five stages of the digital process. It's in the book. We'll go through it in more detail in one of the lectures. A real-world example. So we had this online bank fraud case called SpyEye. It was complicated in both the legal and technical sense because it touches on most chapters in the book. Led to 24 years imprisonment in total. the MO, modus operandi, was just online bank fraud through a Trojan malware system that allowed computers to be monitored and remotely controlled by a botnet. The malware would monitor and gather the data, and when the time was right, the user is online with the bank and inserts a transfer from the victim's account to the money mule account. The mules would withdraw the money and transfer it to a foreign account in a jurisdiction that was difficult to work with. And many times in these crimes, you'll have something called jurisdiction shopping, where the final destination of the ill-gotten gains will be in a jurisdiction that is very difficult to get extradition from or get investigative help with. So we have many different perpetrators who are organized and specialized. One of the things that we see on the dark web is, I think I was talking to somebody before about digital forensics as a service, where what we're trying to do is create a digital forensics infrastructure that can be accessed by the police. Well, one of the things that we see on the darknet is crime as a service, where highly technically proficient criminals are essentially selling their skills online through the dark web, taking money in Bitcoin, in order to create specific malware for a nefarious purpose. So we've got malware programmers, we've got botnet herders, we've got mules, we've even got the resale of criminal services, which I muted before. One of the ways that they've been recruiting their mules is that they put up the ads on the internet, or they spam you, make easy money from home. And essentially what they're doing is they're recruiting you to be a money mule. It's a crime. Don't do it. So the SpyEye case continued. We had 50 million computers infected around the world. How's that for an incident response? 10,000 bank accounts were compromised. As I mentioned before, we had several different hackers, and their accumulated jail term is 24 years. About $1 billion was lost. It's a lot of mules, a lot of money. One of the hackers' clients made over $3 million in just half a year. Make money fast. Of course, it was a very large-scale and complex case. I mean, look at this. Look at these numbers. So we needed to have the analysis of a very large number of victim computers and an online investigation of the sales of malware. You can see how this kind of investigation is not going to be a single investigator sitting at this computer. And because it went across several different jurisdictions, then you need things like the Cybercrime Convention in order to get the different police departments to cooperate with each other. You had the tracing and IDing of the perpetrators, and occasionally you had the anti-forensics involved as well. Okay, I think that's it. Yes, so that was a quick overview of what we'll be doing. We're going to look into more detail into these subjects. I want to thank you all for your attention, and looking forward to seeing you the rest of the year. However, the next lecture will be from a guest lecturer, Andrei Shalaganov. I will be in Groningen, so I will probably join you again for the 2nd of October. Enjoy. thank you very much. I appreciate it. Good, good. Yeah, I think the first one is really important to try and whet people's appetites. Yeah. My name, I'm sorry, I know, you know my name, what's your name?
I mailed you some.
Oh, okay, yes, yes. Welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I'm not telling you, I really looking forward to
this. I'm excellent.
Okay. Thank you.
That makes me feel good. Thank you. You're very welcome. Thank you for your attention. Yes, gentlemen. Yes. Practical. Well, you saw the list of the items, the list of the possible projects, the suggested ones.
Yeah.
So those tend to be more practical than theoretical. For more specifics about what you are expected to do, you should contact Edgar, because Edgar is the project coordinator. He's the one who's going to essentially, so if you just want to do like some research, it's up to Edgar whether that's permissible or not.
Because, we just have the title and we don't know how it consists.
The title and the abstract isn't due for another, week or so?
Sorry?
The title and the abstract, they're not due for a week. You've got a few more days to work through it, right?
Yeah, but that's what we already did. But we have information, even about the question that I asked, which was, it is theoretical or practical?
Well, theoretical is easier to do within the time constraints. Practical is more practical and more useful. So if we do this theoretical thing, then we're more likely to complete it and get a grade. But if we do this practical thing, we're going to have more fun.
Because, for example, we took the project mobile memory forensics. We don't know if we have to do tools to analyze data or to do something which will observe all the data and make a conclusion about this.
Right. These are questions for Edgar, though, because he's the one who's wrangling all the projects. But if for whatever reason you're not satisfied, let me know.
Send your questions about